Okay, talk again. I don't think we're having echoes anymore.
Are you having echoes?
You're having echoes.
Welcome to So Psychological, the podcast where two friends investigate the world of psych.
All the analysis, none of the professionalism.
Hi, and welcome to So Psychological. I'm Susie Jenkins, and this is my co-host, Hearts, Stars, Horseshoes, Clovers, and Blue Moons.
Well, girl, don't you be stealing me pot of gold. What? Silence. Nothing. You got nothing to that?
I got nothing. How about I treat your pot of gold for a summary of he loves me, he loves me not, he loves me, oops, he's dead.
All right, I got you covered on that. It's 1985, and Sean rushes by Henry trying not to get caught. But Henry knows better. Confronting Sean about his new black eye, Henry learns the situation came from classmate Elizabeth retaliating for Sean not listening to her talk after having invited him to join her for lunch. Sean had just had and failed his first date. In the present, Sean is showing off a little bit of this and a whole lot of that down at the police station when Lassie breaks them up to actually request Sean and Gus take a case. Although Gus is suspicious of Lassie's intentions, Sean walks wholeheartedly into the case only to have an encounter of the unexpected kind in the interrogation room, the victim having been left derobed and unconscious in the field is convinced it was aliens at play. When the lads go to investigate the field, they are surprised to find Lassie and Jules already there with another naked victim. Now, Lassie is sure it's just a copycat, but Sean takes note of the stamp mark similar to the first victim, a strap in the field, and how both had streakless tans. Following these clues, they head to the only place in town that can produce such flawless tans, confirming that both men had indeed been customers, as well as discovering that so has Henry. A phone call from the police brings them back to the field to find another victim, except this time, oops, he's dead. Oh, and also pasty white. So there must be another connection. Perhaps the ink stamp also on the third man's hand is the key. So they head to Shenanigans, known for their world-famous Blarney fajitas, and find out from Marvin, the front leprechaun host, that the stamp is for a special speed dating event. And since strange things regarding his identity have been happening, they are off to Chief Vic, where they learn that the death of the third would have been accidental in the process of the drugging. So there is something else afoot. And now the whole gang are going undercover. There's some flirting with Jules by Sean, some cringeworthy moments from Lassie and Gus. And by the end of the night, in addition to Jules and Sean being listed as a perfect match, there's a potential suspect with whom, of course, Gus must now date.
Of course.
So to be safe, right? To be safe, they ultimately take the date to Henry's place. They realize quickly, though, that she's not guilty. Now, Lassie catches Marvin outside a participant's apartment with personal information pages. And so Sean begins to put things together. And he tells them to all gather at the speed dating session where he'll give the reveal. Now, at the event, Sean catches wedding ring tan line clues that put Marvin together with a woman who seems to ask a lot of questions about personal history. And now he has it solved. Marvin is married to Miss Nosy Glenda, and between him collecting the questionnaires and she gathering the info for passcodes through her questioning, they were stealing identities, drugging the victims, and dumping them in a field. The episode ends with Jules wanting to address everything since it seems that she and Sean will be working a little more closely together in the future. Now, Sean diverts and reassures her by simply saying he copied the answers from the test as a joke.
Yeah. Did she really think he sewed his own pajamas?
You never know.
Hey, Lizzie.
Hey, Susie.
I thought maybe it would be interesting to find some Irish myths to discuss during my fun facts. Because there's a pretty blatant one in this episode.
Well, I mean, we do have a leprechaun greeting Sean and Gus at the door of the restaurant.
Yes. And leprechauns aren't real. And they're also apparently very mean.
I guess it's a good thing they're not real then.
It's a good thing they're not real. but the myth I was talking about is the Blarney Stone fajitas. There's no Blarney Stone fajitas in Ireland.
Well, I mean, it would be hard because the Blarney Stone would be like cold, wet, and damp. And I just don't think I could get the sizzle right, you know?
Yeah.
You need a good sizzle for fajitas.
For the fajitas. So, I thought we could just debunk that myth right out of the gate.
Yeah,
so
that's a good.
Jumping on to a couple more. There's a couple here that are specifically about like St. Patrick's Day. So pinching people for not wearing green, not a tradition in Ireland for St. Patrick's Day.
Where did this start?
Why I do
are
not
we so mean. Are we leprechauns?
I do not know. I did not find where it started. I just found that that's like only a United States thing.
Ouch.
I know. I'm like, why is pinching people for fun fun? I don't think it's fun.
No. No.
But I always busted out. I could never get pinched because my eyes are green.
I know. That's like such a built-in excuse.
Exactly. Like if I forgot that it was St. Patrick's Day, boom, green eyes.
There you go.
The next one is the myth about St. Patrick driving out the snakes. This is also an Irish myth because
he didn't have a car.
He might have had a car. What was it, 842? He might have had a car. The problem would have been that there were no snakes there to begin with. So they have discovered that there are no snakes indigenous to that island, even though there are snakes indigenous to England. There was in England and like the mainland Europe where snakes could get to England, but there's never been a land bridge from Ireland to England or mainland Europe. And so no snakes are actually indigenous to that place, which I think is kind of cool. It's like the opposite of Australia.
Totally the opposite of Australia.
Where it's like,
in that sense,
every terrifying snake
can't get anywhere but there.
Yeah. Although I would really like to visit both, so. the next one is like all of the mint stuff for St. Patrick's Day. Like if you
it's
get
green, duh.
Yeah, if you get a dessert, it's always like mint flavored. And on St. Patrick's Day, that's not a thing over there. Like if they're going to make it a nice treat dessert, chances are pretty good they're going to be putting a little bit of whiskey in it and not mint flavor.
Sounds delicious.
It does. So they were talking about some sort of buttercream whiskey, buttercream pie. We might need to find this recipe, Lizzie. Because when you cook it, it cooks all the alcohol out. We could actually eat the whiskey buttercream pie while podcasting and not have to worry about getting a little tipsy. Unlike Lassiter in last week's episode. I also looked up shenanigans, which is a phrase in Irish language. And it's like, I didn't even try to remotely pronounce it. It's like six words long. It's a little phrase. And it means sly as a fox. And we've kind of, yeah, we've kind of just kind of swirled it into one word that means shenanigans. And I was like, as long as I'm at it, I might as well look up hooligans, because I feel like shenanigans and hooligans go together.
Well, like, you often mash them together.
I do. I like to say shenhooligans. They're little shenhooligans, which I guess hooligans means troublemakers. So when I call, when I say that we're up to shenhooligans, we're being sly troublemakers.
See, that's a great word.
Yes. And then the last myth I wanted to talk about real quick is corned beef and cabbage, because there is some like debate whether or not this is a traditional Irish meal. So I looked into it a little bit, and what I found was in the mid 1800s, Ireland was the number one in the area, number one exporter of beef. But the Irish people either were not allowed to or could not afford to eat or purchase the beef. They ate this meal. They would have bacon. So this is kind of like, it's not really like what we in America eat as bacon. It's more like a big ham steak. So they would have bacon or lamb and cabbage. So when the famine happened in 1865 and so many Irish immigrated to the United States, they could suddenly afford and were allowed to eat beef. And so they started eating this more traditional Irish recipe of corned beef and cabbage, because they actually could now afford to have this like delicacy. So it actually really makes a lot of sense why corned beef and cabbage would be like the go-to meal to celebrate St. Patrick's Day.
Yeah, I can see that.
And now I want some corned beef and cabbage to go with our, what are we having? Whiskey, buttermilk, pie?
Just tell me we're finishing the meal with an Irish coffee and we'll be grand.
Okay, I'm in for that too. Can my coffee be decaf though?
As long as it's... I'll give you leeway if it's real this time.
Okay. Okay. I'm in. Let's go. You know how there's like a sitcom trope where like all the different characters of the main characters of the sitcom date each other? Like,
yeah.
1 year they'll date this person in the sitcom, and then 2 years later they date somebody else.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's this episode of Psych. Except, you know, not cheesy and
trope. Every 3 minutes instead of every 2 years.
Yes. So in this episode, we get to see Jules date Carlton and Sean and some dude that doesn't bowl well.
Yeah, I think his name is Kyle.
Kyle. Yeah, not bowling well. That's a deal breaker.
Apparently.
Apparently. So which one of these dates that we saw out of all the speed dating, which one was your favorite?
Carlton and Jules, hands down.
Oh, mine too. I loved it so much.
Yeah, I thought it was just so great. Like, because, you know, there she is and she's actually very comfortable.
Yeah, she's so comfortable and he's just cracking his knuckles.
She's very at ease with herself. And, you know, he sees that he's going to have to sit down where she is. And he like tries to go to the next person instead. And somebody beats him to it. So he has to sit down with her. And he's just like, you can tell how uncomfortable he is. He can't handle the context that this is in. And you can see her almost like, she's gotten so comfortable. I think, you know, she started to feel more comfortable in their partnership and she's more familiar with him and his ways and even his awkwardness with vulnerability and things like that. And so at this point, she's actually kind of just enjoying this. She's sitting back and kind of laughing.
Yeah.
I mean, not cruelly laughing, but just kind of
she's amused by the fact
chuckling
that
he just at his awkwardness.
Yeah, even though he, it's, I don't think that it, it's that he's uncomfortable with Juliet as a person or a
partner. I don't think so.
It's the situation itself. He can't,
he can't get like, past the idea that here, they're on a date.
Right. Cause it's not like, cause he could be just like, I'm sitting here with my partner. We could chat about the case. We could chat about whatever. He can't get past the context that they're sitting across from each other and they're supposed to be dating.
Yeah. They're supposed to be quote unquote on a date.
He can't even like look her in the eyes. I mean, it's so awkward.
Well, and the thing is none of them are actually on dates. They're all working. Like this right? is a work event that is being sponsored by the SBPD. And yeah, and he's just so uncomfortable.
I mean, because the facilitator comes up and she of course, you know, not knowing they're police officers undercover, is trying to encourage some conversation. Yeah. And she's like, oh, you could tell her she's pretty. And he just instantly responds with the most disgusted, like, no, can do.
As no, can do. Like
the most horrifying person in the world. And yet, you know, it's just because that does not work within the framework of
the confines of Carlton's
because
worldview.
He just seems so, I don't know. I'm usually really good at synonyms, but uncomfortable is the only word I can think of because that's just written all over his face.
He's so language. Uncomfortable.
Yeah. I loved it.
And it's just so brilliantly done. Like the way that she watches him crack his knuckles and And then we get to see Sean and Jules on their first date.
Yeah, so much chemistry.
So much chemistry. The friendly banter between these two is so apparent.
And it's so cute. It's just like really cute.
Yeah. Like even if nothing happens, you kind of know that they can be really good friends.
Yeah, I mean, Juliet makes it very clear at the very beginning, Sean, this isn't a date, it's work. But
yes.
he still kind of plays with it, you know? Yeah, but you can ask me anything. Let's just, you know, what do you want to know? And it's just really sweet how the banter is back and forth and how she kind of picks up on those little things that would slip by other people and she throws it out and questions them, not like as an interrogation, but just as banter, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's really fun. Although it is interesting because he says that lying is unbecoming, said the liar.
Said the liar. Let's look at Gus on dates because Gus is just, he's just so Gus. He's just so Gus the whole time. He stays on task. He's like hyper-focused on what kind of shoes. They found a strap at the crime scene. And right. What kind of shoes? Is your closet filled with high heels?
So, folks, what you can't see is you can't see Susie putting blinders like a horse would have against her eyes. This is the gesture she is making because this is what Gus did. He focused, hyper-focused on one clue. I mean, surely there were other questions he could be asking.
Surely. He's such an on-task person. Like,
I mean,
and those
so
poor ladies.
Many women.
Like, why are you asking me about my shoes?
So many women wear strappy-heeled shoes. That's not going to prove the killer. That's just going to be one factor, you know? And he just comes out so cringy. So cringy. It is amazing, though, that he gets a date out of it anyway. The person still agrees to go on a date, despite the fact that he's been cringy through the whole evening.
Yeah.
But yet again, another time when he's having to be set up to go on a date with the potential killer.
Is the killer.
I mean, what's up, Sean? Why you always got to do this to Gus? Put him on the date.
Oh, yeah. Poor Gus.
I mean, we say that, but then again, I don't know if I can feel too bad for him after how cringy he was on those dates.
That's true.
If I can say one word, Lassie, uncomfortable, Gus, cringe.
Yeah.
I'm all out of synonyms today.
People. Lassie on his speed dates was the same kind of thing. Like, he was interrogating these women. What kind of car do you drive? You know, and staying hyper-focused and not really engaging these women in any way, which brings me to Sean and Glenda.
Uh-huh.
Glenda, who we find out is one of the killers.
The murderer.
When you watch how Sean has the date with this lady, first off, it's just so Enderheim-y.
Yes. Hofer Enderheim-y.
Hofer Enderheim-y and Buzz Teets. But Sean, when you watch how he's quote unquote interrogating this lady, finding out about her, what he's actually doing is he's getting her to ask questions. He's finding out what type of information. And I would assume he's kind of doing this with the other dates as well. He's using this time to find out what these people are asking about the people that they're dating. And she asks like all the questions except what was the name of your elementary school?
Yeah, totally. And that would be easy enough to find online once you've asked all these questions.
Oh, surely. Well, especially if you're looking up, you know, Mr. Hoofen Enderheim-y.
Well, you would think, but I'm pretty sure she didn't find anyone online there. Can you imagine her typing that in?
I'm thinking like 2022, like, and you search for things online, you then get like advertisements for those things on all of your media. Yeah. What on earth? When she searched for Hoofen Enderheim-y and Buzz Teets, what on earth happened to all of her socials? Like, I'm terrified.
I guess it's a good thing it wasn't 2022 then. But you're right. Like, Sean had a totally different approach to the interrogations, where he was really kind of just listening to people and what they were volunteering and how they were asking. He was getting a sense of the person. Whereas both Lassie and Gus, we saw, were very focused on details, or in Gus's case, one detail.
Yes. Clues.
Yeah.
Very
interesting.
I don't remember seeing Jules on any dates other than with Carlton and Sean. So we didn't really get to see her like interrogation style. I'm saying interrogations really loosely. Interrogation style with the gentlemen that were at the speed dating event.
Yeah, but they didn't know that. They didn't know exactly what was going on or how.
Yeah, no, they didn't know. But I'm just saying us as the audience. It's okay that we didn't get to see her in that.
And that's probably why we didn't. Okay, but there is one more date that you didn't mention.
Yes.
And that is at the end with Sean and the blondie.
Yes, the girl in the hot pink.
They are having a date that's going very well.
Yes, it does seem to be going well.
I mean, this is a very Sean-like date from what we've seen of Sean on dates so far. And you could imagine him totally running with this and them going out again.
But
it's interrupted by Jules, who happens to have made a match with him. The facilitator had come up in the very beginning after they did their forms and had alerted them that they were 100% compatible match, right?
Yes.
Which I loved their reactions, because Jules's reaction was, first, I need to go get a drink. I need a drink. Mm-hmm. And his was like, I need to run to the loo. So his was
immediate escape. And hers was like, how do I cope with this?
Right.
Yes.
So very different ways to handle it. And I love that. Here we have it. He's actually having a successful date. The second Jules comes up, he doesn't just disengage from the conversation to chat with Jules, he actually ruins any potential
ruins the
for that date
yeah.
going
this
further.
This is my parole officer.
Just for the chance to talk to Jules. And knowing that that's going to end that. Because just even for the moment to chat with Jules is going to be more important than whatever potential future this might have. And I think that's really an insightful moment to watch. And then to see them together
mm-hmm.
in their interactions, it's really interesting.
Yeah. I have always wondered, did Sean really cheat on the exam? Or did Sean not cheat, but say that so that he would like have an out so that he wouldn't have to deal with being rejected by Juliet in this moment?
I tend to think neither.
Really?
I tend to think it's a different option altogether.
Okay, do tell.
I tend to think that there is the chance he did not cheat, but instead of telling Juliet this to give himself an out, I think he's doing it to give her the out.
Oh, I didn't think about that.
I think he's almost doing it to protect her from feeling the weight of having to reject him in the moment.
Oh, that's so much sweeter than what I thought.
Because Gus asks him how it goes, and you know, he just is like, there's deal breakers, you know? And you just
apparently bowling, and I don't bowl well.
I just feel like his face has these expressions where you can just tell he's kind of sad. And so you feel like if she hadn't made it clear that because they're gonna work together, I think he would have run with it. I think he might have had the courage.
Been like, oh, we match.
I think he might have had the courage to at least make a little bit of a step if, you know, I don't know that he would have made a full step, but at least a little bit of step in that direction instead of giving himself an out completely. And so I think he was really doing it in a way to save her the burden of that. And to make it a little easier. That's what I think.
That's so sweet. Fun
fact. Hey, Susie.
Hey, Lizzie.
Have you ever been speed dating?
I have not. I've been slow dating. Been on the same date for like 28 years now.
Seems like it. That date's going well for you then?
Sure. Yeah.
Sure. Well, the reason I mention it is because obviously speed dating features in this episode. So I thought I would, you know, kind of, for my fun fact, meander down that little dating path.
Ooh, fun. Okay. Give me some details.
So this episode starts with, you know, going back with Sean being on a date that he's not even aware of, right? And so uh-huh. I was thinking back to even when we're kids, like Sean's age, how there were all these little games that you'd play about like, oh my goodness, who am I going to date? You know?
Yeah. Or like, you know, he loves me not with the daisies.
Right. And that's where we get the title for this episode. So that was the first thing is that, you know, one of the things that little girls would do is they'd pick a flower and do the whole, he loves me, he loves me not, he loves me, he loves me not. And of course, mathematically, depending on an odd or even number, you would get the dream guy of your choice.
Yeah. Well, I guess mathematically, you should have counted your petals before you started the he loves me, he loves me not, so that you knew where it was going to end.
The bonus is if it doesn't work out, potentially you have a field full of flowers, you can keep going.
That's true. Yeah.
Well, like I remember like with us, like sometimes it would just be like a magic eight ball, right? Like where it would be like, okay, I'm going to ask you about like the guy from 90210, for example, Juan Priestley. I'm going to ask you about Juan Priestley for a minute. And it'll be like, oh, does he like me? And you pick the number and it'll be like, yes, no, maybe. So there were a lot of iterations of this. And it was just like,
yes,
to play. And it was like, it left an infinite number of possibilities. Another version was MASH. Do you remember MASH?
Yes.
Now, I don't know if the guys out there know these things. This is what girls did. I don't know. Maybe not all girls, but a lot of girls did this. And I don't know if
if guys knew about this, but MASH had a lot of iterations as well. But basically, it started with a word, MASH, all capital letters at the top. And this stood for like mansion, apartment, shack, and house, right? Mm-hmm. Although like shack could also be like, I think shed or a lot of different, you know, things. But basically an accommodation of sorts that began with that letter. And so there was also like smash, which was like, apparently I hadn't heard of this, but when I looked it up, it was apparently a common one, which was like a school bus. Oh, so school bus was your future accommodation. And then of course the typical MASH. There's also cash. I remember cash as well. It was like castle, apartment, shack house. There was bash, which is pretty horrible. Is like, is it just like box, apartment, shack house? And as I was looking this up, I was remembering, wow, we were kind of really shallow as children.
As children are. Because he was focused on his tots, man.
But anyway, so what they would do is they would do the accommodation type at the top, and then you'd do like the name of your crushes on the side, but it'd always be like a couple that you liked, and then maybe the person doing it would throw one in that you didn't like, you know, there would always be that one that was like thrown in the option, you know, and then there would be like how many kids you'd have on the side or like whatever you wanted. And then any options on the bottom. And so then they would draw a spiral in the center. And then when you said stop or they said stop, because you could choose how you did it, they'd draw a line through it, count how many times the line crossed through the spiral, and then they'd go around, and every time they hit the number, so that number was like, there were seven times it crossed through the spiral, they would count each one of those letters, M-A-S-H, that's 1, 2, 3, 4, and then go down in the order clockwise around all the things on all the lists that were written around in a circle around this spiral. And when it hit number seven, you'd cross it out. And you'd keep doing that and then go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, cross it out until you had one of each category left. And that was your future. None of those things panned out, fortunately, because that's just not the way things work.
Well, I probably would be married to an imaginary character by now who no longer exists.
Yeah, you wouldn't be on one long date.
No.
So to jump into a little more reality, we're now adults and we're looking at the world of speed dating, because from the 40s to the 50s and even up until the 80s, the predominant way that people met each other that wasn't through immediate friends was through their family or through their schooling, their education. And then it started in the 70s to kind of taper into like their job. And so by the 80s, it actually shifted where instead of from the family and from their schooling, it shifted after friends to their workplace or out in society. So like a restaurant or a cafe or a bar, that became mm-hmm. the scene where they met people. But in the late 90s, this decreased as well as them meeting people through their friends. Both of those hit a rapid decline. And so there was a need for people to be able to start to meet each other. And trying to find ways for people to date was kind of brought about. The earliest documented event of speed dating was in 1996. And the idea behind it was not just to get people to meet each other, but it was this idea of giving people who maybe don't get a chance to get a chance, because it, rather than it being just like the most outgoing guy and the most modelly like girl, to give more common folk a chance, you know, maybe mm-hmm. to let the wallflowers bloom a bit, so to speak. And so in 1996, that first event was held. And in 1998, the term speed dating actually became trademarked by an organization that catered to an Orthodox Jewish society. But the concept behind speed dating branched out all over the world, and you started having these speed dating events all over. What's interesting about this is it's not the first way people were already hooking up, because like I said, from the 50s and the 60s, you know, they met through people, but already they were trying something called internet dating. Now, we didn't have the internet at that time. However, IBM was creating these monster computers at the time, and they decided to run matchmaking algorithms. So from the 50s to the 60s, IBM actually ran a series of matchmaking algorithms to see if it could even work, and had in their first run, like 49 matches successfully paired. And they did that for a whole decade, actually almost two decades. And then in 1968, MIT had a program called DataMate that they launched.
DataMate. That does not sound
partners.
Doesn't sound like a good catchy name.
I know. But then in the 70s and the 80s, things started to expand again. Remember I said people were meeting people more through society, but then if you're not out in those settings, it'd be a little harder. So people started trying things. You started to get the kind of revisiting the idea of mail order. You started having video type dating, where you could go and you could make a video cassette and you could be matched, make that way. They had teledating where you could be matched and have telephone dates. And then when the internet started to be formed, they had chat rooms that weren't just like chat room you could meet anywhere, but they specifically had programs where you could be matched and you could do like electronic pen pals to meet somebody and exchange and to form a relationship. In 1994 was the first official online dating system, and that was kiss.com in 1994. And things have just taken off since there. And actually now internet dating and meeting at cafes, restaurants, and bars trumps all other forms of meeting, including being introduced by friends.
Oh, wow.
In our current modern world. Yeah. And so it's just interesting. Now, the one last fun fact about this, even though the first documented event, speed dating event as we know it, was in 1996, they can kind of trace it back as far as like the 19th century.
Oh, interesting.
So there was something called... There was something called New Year's Calling, where if you were an eligible young lady, they would set and arrange an open house night where they would invite all the eligible bachelors, both people they knew and actual strangers, you know, because that's not dangerous. But they were only allowed to have 10 to 15 minutes to introduce themselves and to form a connection with the girl before they moved on and the next one could come to like prove why they could court her.
So kind of like the ball in Cinderella, except instead of the prince, it's the female that's like, I need all of the eligible bachelors to come to my house.
Well, and if we think about it, if we think of all those different period dramas, we see those things kind of happen because those ladies are like presented into society and then they have their gentleman callers. But there was like specifically a night, New Year's Calling, where they had almost like a speed dating night where the men would come to them.
That's pretty funny.
Now, I don't know if any of them scored perfectly in their algorithms, but I'm sure.
Do they sew their pajamas at home?
Yeah, I don't know, but I'm sure many a match were made.
Many great matches.
I'm just assuming it's a lot more successful than the whole, you know, M-A-S-H, will he, won't he? He loves me, he loves me not. He loves me, he loves me not. All right, so we get to see a little bit more of Henry in this episode. And we get to see how he has changed and developed in ways that we might not be familiar with, because we're mostly familiar with him through Sean's flashbacks. So Sean's perceptions as a kid, right?
Yes.
So we're actually getting to see all of these changes because Sean is getting to experience these. And these are not things that Sean is quite ready for or experienced with. I mean, his dad's taking baths. His dad's basting roasts.
His dad's doing the Instantan process.
Exactly. Who knows? Carlton and Jay are probably in the living room right now having a nice chat over what decor or the next dish to make, you know?
Yeah, they're probably telling him to take down some of that fishing.
I think that's the first decor thing they would do. I mean, that's the first thing I would do, but to each his own. So anyway, we see all of this happening and Sean really doesn't know what to think about it. And I was thinking about how, you know, like on one hand, actually, Henry defends himself saying that some of these things are not new. These are part of who he's always been, that he actually always took baths because they actually helped him relax and that he could solve a case that way, you know, really process it through. But that would be something.
And they're super manly, like John Wayne.
Exactly. Super manly. I'm sure
Sure, John Wayne had gardenia mango bubbles in his bath. And, you know, he said that he would use them to help relax and solve cases. It's just that Sean was never witness to that part of his life. And so this is all very new, and Sean has trouble processing it to the point where he like copes by his usual way of joking, calling him, you know, George Hamilton, or telling people that aliens swapped out his father for Jose Hubert. You know, he just can't come to terms that this is his dad. And it made me think about how isn't that so true? How there's always a part in life where we have to switch from seeing our parents as just parents, but also as eye-to-eye adults.
Yes.
Because ultimately, we want them to see us as adults when we become adults.
We do. But having to see your parents as adults, like, I think that's one of, like, the hardest things in transitioning from a child to an adult is to see your parents as human and for parents to see their kids as adults.
Right. We always want to be seen as the adult, but it's so hard to see them outside of that context of just a parent. And for Sean, it's going to be hard for him to see him outside of the context of what kind of a parent he
is. Oh, exactly.
Henry. And that's why I think he's having trouble getting over like the mango gardenia, you know?
Sean has always seen his dad as having like these hard-lined definitions of masculinity. And I think to a certain extent that Henry does have some hard-lined definitions of masculinity. But I also think to a certain extent, maybe Sean just is perceiving those definitions of masculinity. Like that he says he took baths his whole life, that he's solved many crimes in a very manly bathtub with mango gardenia, I'm sure. You know, but we also... He's cooking in this episode, which seems to kind of throw Sean for a loop. And
but Henry's always liked to grill steak.
Maybe Sean is thrown off because he's cooking indoors. Like that's maybe not quite as masculine in like however Sean perceives those lines. And maybe he cooked a lot more while Sean was growing up, and Sean was just never aware of his dad, you know, participating in the kitchen. Plus, I don't think you can grill like every meal all the time.
That's debatable. However,
back well, at to some the point, it would rain. And that would still be
still debatable. However, I think like, Sean is really having to deal with this. What is his perception? Because Sean, obviously, it's not that Sean has an issue with any of these concepts. You know, Sean is very open about his ideas and very free. And so he doesn't have a problem with these things. He just has a problem thinking of his dad.
Of his dad doing those things. And then even Henry comes back when he's like, you're cooking a roast? And he's like, it's meat. It's man food. If I could have, I would have gone out and hunted it and butchered it myself. And, you know, so like you can still kind of see that shadow maybe of the hard-lined masculine rules that Henry has, but they're still not get that, what Sean thought they were.
Yeah, you almost get that feeling like that Henry's saying that almost like to put up that perception, like that maybe all of this was this like way that he was fitting into the society he was in, that he had to put that up, you know?
Yeah.
And so Sean was reading him right, but again, he was reading up a facade to some degree.
Yes.
Not entirely, but to some degree. And so it's this really fascinating thing. And I think that's the challenge for us is always to try to see the person outside of the parent, you know, because they are whole people. And, you know, in this case, Henry's not just a parent, you know, he's having to reconnect with Sean as a father because they're reconnecting after this long separation. So they're having to reforge that connection as a father and a son, and they're navigating these tricky waters because they both have their, well, their memories and filters on those memories of how things went down. And yet now they're having to also navigate who they are just as human people.
Yeah. And it seems like, it really does seem like when you are isolated from somebody, it's like all of the relational dynamic with that person goes on pause. Like any growth, any changes, it all goes on pause. And so it's like your perception of that person stays paused until you're with them again. Yeah. So if there's been a big span, you know, he's not only having to learn who his dad is as a human person, but he's having to learn who his dad is over the last, you know, 7-8 years, that their relationship has kind of been on pause.
Yeah. And this is happening while Henry is also evolving.
Yes.
Because Henry is a single guy and he's coming to terms with who he is and exploring the world out there a little more. He's over time gotten a little more comfortable in his own skin, not as afraid to say he's a man who likes baths. You know, he's venturing out into the dating world. So he's going to take that effort and, you know, go get the tan and do the different things that he feels would, you know, that he sees that maybe other guys who are in the dating world are doing. That's a new venture for him. You know, he's having to discover and do something new. And so he's growing in the process of this too. So there's a lot of shifting happening all at the same time. I think Henry was pretty settled in of himself for a long time because he'd been in a long-term relationship. But now that he's getting out there, he's realizing, I want to do something a little different. Mm-hmm. I want to try the new things that are happening. And, you know, even if you're not in a relationship or not pursuing a relationship, you can easily say, I want to put that effort towards myself and actually say, you know, I care and I want to, you know, I want to relax in a mango gardenia bath. All those things are recognizing there's worth to these things. They don't have to be the worth. And I don't think they should be the culminating worth. Maybe we should be a little kind to ourselves as we grow. And he's doing that, but it's definitely a change for Sean to see because he's not known Henry to be very kind in many ways.
Okay, as we wrap up this episode, was there anything, any other things that stuck out to you?
Why, yes, there was. In fact, I saw a number of familiar faces in this episode. And oh my goodness, the 6 degrees of psych is insane.
Yes.
So I thought we would be remiss to not mention it. Honestly, there's no way I could include all of it because I would have to do so much research and there would be lists so long, it would take forever. So I'll try to do this very quickly, just with a few, I think, key things that people will be interested in. We have 5 guests on this episode. We have Malcolm Scott. Malcolm Scott played Naked Dude, number 1. We have Peter Benson, who played, Peter Benson, who played Naked Dude, number 2. We have Colin Cunningham, who played Marvin. We have Terrell Rothery, who played Marvin's wife, the nosy Glinda. And we have Ellie Harvey, who played the little facilitator for all love at the singles speed dating, right?
Mm-hmm.
Oh my goodness. Do you know what all of these people have in common?
6 degrees of psych.
So much. So in addition to all being in this one episode of psych, 3 of them are in multiple Hallmark films. Peter Benson is famous for being one of the detectives in the Aurora Tea Garden mystery series, where Ellie Harvey plays the librarian for Aurora Tea Garden in that series.
Okay.
Now, Terrell Rothery plays on Cedar Cove, which is a Hallmark series, right? Now, Colin Cunningham and Malcolm Scott are missing on that, but don't worry, they catch up in other places.
Colin Cunningham is famous for Falling Skies. Many people might recognize him there. Where you might recognize him also is from Stargate Atlantis or Stargate Continuum, where Peter Benson played in Stargate 1. Terrell Rathery is famous for Stargate 1. And Malcolm Scott, guess what? He also guest starred on Stargate 1. Poor Ellie Harvey missed a Stargate appearance.
She missed her Stargate opportunity.
Oh, but that's okay, because she was able to be a guest star on a little show called Eureka that many of us love from the Sci-Fi Network, where poor Malcolm missed out, but Terrell Rathery also got to be a guest star on Eureka. Colin Cunningham was a guest star on Eureka. Peter Benson was not a guest star on Eureka. However, he does, like I say, play the detective on Aurora Tea Garden.
Uh-huh.
Well, Aurora Tea Garden's now husband on that series is played by Niall Matter, who was a series regular on Eureka.
Eureka.
Now, all five of them did play on Supernatural as guest stars, all of them. And all of them, oh, this is where you're really going to love it. With the exception of Peter Benson, Colin Cunningham, Terrell Rathery, Ellie Harvey, and Malcolm Scott all had appearances on The Dead Zone featuring Anthony Michael Hall.
Who is also the chief in the last season.
I know, right? So many ways to come back. Now, one more here to throw in that's just really fun. In the end, if you'll remember, Jules is on a date and the guy's quite the adventurer, you know, bit off his own thumb, drank his own urine, that kind of thing. The man playing that was Andy Berman. He's known because he's the producer of Psych. But he's had many guest star roles. He played Chuck on The Wonder Years, which is fantastic because Dan Lauria, who played the father on Wonder Years, also a guest star on Psych from Poker, I Barely Knew Her.
Yes, which is coming up very soon.
The great connection with the new remake Wonder Years, which Dulé Hill is the lead character in. And then Andy Berman also played in Wings, which was a little sitcom that ran from 1990 to 1997, which co-starred Steven Weber, also known as Uncle Jack. It also starred Tony Shalhoub, also known as Mr. Monk, who airs on the same.
That's some lots of 6 degrees of Psych.
All over the place with that.
Wow. So what about your favorite?
So if you watched this, you saw those familiar faces. They're from everywhere. And they literally were all in those places
literally
together.
Everywhere. So what was your favorite quote?
Oh, my favorite quote was a Henry quote. Whatever, Sean. All I know is when I varnish my boat and I don't want it to streak, I sand off a layer first. Same thing goes with tanning.
I too, very, very much love that quote. The level of class.
It's just so brash. I love it. He's just like, he's being all like fluffy. And then his words come out and he's so Henry.
And he's so Henry. Yeah. My favorite is the Sean quote when at the very beginning in the flashback, he's telling his dad that he got punched. Dad says, "What was she doing?" Sean says, "She was talking about something. I don't know. I was focusing on my tater tots." I love that so much. That's like.
But do you love tater tots?
I don't. But I love people that love tater tots.
Do you love tachos?
I don't know what a tacho is.
Tachos is nachos with tater tots instead of tortilla chips.
I probably would love tachos. Husband makes me cheese tots. Those are crazy good.
That sounds like your 27-year-long date food. Guys, hints for a successful date. Make her cheese tots.
Cheese tots.
That's what Sean was paying attention to. That's what would win him over. I don't know. It worked for you.
Maybe everybody needs to make cheese tots.
And then everybody can eat them.
And then everybody can be happy.
All right, guys, we hope that you enjoyed the show. Thanks for hanging in there with us through the distance and through the congestion.
And the glitches.
Thanks for the grace. But we love being able to do this podcast with you and for you. So please contact us anytime. You can always find us at SusieandLizzie@gmail.com. That's
SusieandLizzie@gmail.com. You can find us on our socials. That's Facebook at So Psychological and Twitter and Insta at
Susie and Lizzie, SusieandLizzie, or So Psychological. We hope to see you soon.
We'll see you next week for our aftercast.
This has been So Psychological. You've heard it both ways.
I hear that.